So I want to welcome you to the Tate, to Tate Britain. I'm the director of Tate Britain. My name is Penelope Curtis, and I've been learning a little bit more today about the amazing event that is about to unfold. And it seems to me that the combination of NADFAS, which I suppose I have associated, and I've talked about whether I can say this or not, with people who are older rather than younger, and a very young audience that's come from all over Britain, is a really fantastic combination, and also seems to make very good sense of the subject, the idea of the old and the new, the venerable and the young, and bringing different generations together. And I think that's very much what I think we can do here at Tate Britain, because we have a collection which is both old and new. We have some art that's 500 years old, and we also have art that's absolutely contemporary. So it's very much about history, but history now. And in many ways, I suppose I feel that nothing is ever really historic, because it becomes new and alive again and again and again. And that's one of the great fascinations of art and of history, and why I'm very happy to be working here, because I'm interested in that relationship of the old and the new, and how things are always contemporary. As soon as things speak to you in the here and the now, then they're contemporary again. Conservation is obviously a subject which can be understood in many different ways. So at a very basic level, museums conserve art, and that doesn't necessarily mean they have to do anything. It means they just keep it safe, look after it. And some things are very stable. So pieces of stone, for example, might not need conservation. They're very stable, and some of the oldest things in our cultures are the most stable things. But other things are much more fragile, much more vulnerable, and they need a helping hand. So I know that today you're going to look at a range of those different kinds of helping hands that art cries out for at certain moments. And I guess you might be going to look at the John Martin exhibition, and in particular one of the paintings there, which was actually affected by the huge flood that swept in on Tate, the Tate Gallery, in 1928, when the Thames broke its banks. So we actually very directly had to deal with the results of natural disaster in the Tate collection. And you'll see a painting which has been very fully restored after that flood. And it's a painting in a show which is all about natural disaster. So it makes a very interesting connection between art and nature, and how things can be recuperated and brought back to life. I remember once talking at a conference at the Royal Academy about why do we care about art, and it's a very fundamental question, and the most important one. Very often the most important questions are the ones that don't get asked or don't get answered, and we were challenged to really try and think about why we care about art. And that was just after some of the bombings in London, during the attempted terrorist attacks. And I had had a very particular experience just a week earlier, when I'd been trying to get to Munich for a curatorial reason, and I had tremendous problems because all the tubes closed down, the buses closed down, and I finally got to Heathrow, and there were huge signs all over the airport talking about terrorist alerts all over London and how London was closing down. And suddenly, contemporary life felt very, very fragile. But I got my plane and I got to Munich, and I thought I'd take a train to the main station, and then I thought I would just walk through Munich. And I discovered that one of the museums, unexpectedly, was open late at night. So I went in. It was the Glyptothek, which is the sculpture museum in Munich. And I walked in, and I guess I'd had a very shaky day. I felt quite upset by the whole business, and found myself looking at busts of Roman heroes, Roman emperors, from 2,000 years ago. And suddenly, at moments like that, I think you can be really touched that things that are 2,000 years have survived, and contemporary life might feel very fragile and dangerous even, but some things have lasted for millennia. And I think that's when art can really touch us, that we realize that some of these things are still with us in the here and now, but they've survived for 2,000 years. And people have cared about them, and that's why they have survived. And I suppose the other interesting thing about conservation is that often the important things are looked after, but it's the less important things that need extra loving care. And we change the way we judge things. So I think a century ago there was a certain idea of what was important in art. Now we're aware that many other things are important too. Little things that maybe children make, or that unskilled artists make, things that never would have been in a museum traditionally, we now realise that that's just as important as a famous painting. And those little things, they're the things that are particularly fragile because they would have got thrown away. And now we look after them with much greater attention and care. So it's partly about looking after things that we know are important, but it's also about changing our judgment and thinking about how things that may not have been seen to be important at the time, we now know tell us a different story, help us to understand our past and how that past speaks to us now in the present. So it's really fantastic to see so many people who've come, I'm told, from all over Britain, young people, to come and work at Tate Britain today and think about conservation and what it means and why it's important and all its different definitions. So thank you for coming. And I'd like to thank NADFA so very much for organising this. It's a great idea. I hope you will be able to do more. The idea that a members' organisation, which I think is 90,000 across Britain, can make this kind of project happen with a new generation thinking about the relationship between young people and historic art is a wonderful project. So I very much hope you enjoy the day. Thank you for being here. Thank you to the organisers. And I'll now pass on to my namesake, Sean Curtis, to give you some of the housekeeping notes and organisational aspects of the day. Thank you.
Thank you to Penelope. My name's Sean Curtis. I'm the curator of young people's programmes here at Tate Britain across Tate Modern also. I'd just like to say thank you and welcome. I've a few safety announcements before we begin, so we'll just get those out of the way. We're not expecting any kind of test of the fire alarms, so in the case of the alarm going off, please leave by the nearest marked exit and vacate the building. There are several meeting points, but there will be staff available to advise, it's just important that you leave the building. As you will probably not fail to notice, you have all been assigned a wristband today. The wristband has a colour and a number to indicate your group for the day. And for that group, you will be assigned a volunteer for the day who will assist you in making your way to and from your workshops and back here to the auditorium for the sections of the day we'll be holding here. So if you could please ensure that you stay in your designated group, we can then manage the numbers in workshops, because many of the workshops that we've organised for today take place back of house here at Tate, quite small and confined spaces with obviously very valuable artefacts around, so we would really appreciate it if you would help us manage the numbers. Okay, so you've come today to the Why Save Anything Symposium. This has been produced in partnership with NADFAS, it's the National Association of Decorative and Fine Arts Societies, and the aim of the day is to encourage you all to explore questions surrounding conservation. So why do we conserve culture in the context of galleries and museums, and particularly in light of the shifting and changing definitions of such institutions? You also explore what conservation means at this point in the beginning of the 21st century in terms of digital archiving. So we'll explore the overarching question in a number of ways. I don't know if it would be possible to move the slide on, if that's, I don't know if there's any technical assistance there, but if not. The schedule for the day, actually, you should all have a programme of events, and the schedule is contained within there. So we're obviously at the 11 o'clock-ish mark in the auditorium, and we will have some presentations from artists, conservators, curators and lecturers, each addressing key questions raised by this overarching question of why save anything, who I'll hand over to shortly. At 11:30, we will make our way out to your morning workshops, returning at 25 past 12 to the Claw Foyer, where you'll be able to collect your lunches. 10 past 1, we will make our way back out to workshops in different locations from the morning. At 5 past 2, we will return again to the Claw Foyer. At this point, you can gather your responses, because the final element of the day is a Q&A with an assembled panel of specialists in the field of conservation, artists, conservators, curators. So we're really encouraging you to generate questions to fuel what should be a really interesting debate. I'm sure many questions will be raised over the course of the day for you seeing the practice and exploring some of the more theoretical considerations around conservation. But we really do hope you'll be able to contribute in that. And at 3:30, we will finish. Okay, that's enough from me. I will now hand over to the artist Richard Woods for our initial presentation. I hope you have a good day. I'll speak to you after our speakers have presented, and give you some more information about how we're going to make our way to the workshops. Thank you.
Is that working? Okay. Hi. I'm just going to do a very, very short introduction to four projects that I've worked on over the past, 8 years, I think. Really, I suppose, hopefully they're interesting because they're all, the idea, it's kind of important that none of the pieces existed beyond the installation. So basically all of the pieces, probably, I would say 6 months at the maximum, that they all sort of existed for, and then nothing really remains apart from the photographs. The first piece was called Refit, and as a young artist, I worked laying laminate flooring as my job, which was an interesting thing to do for a number of years. And I became very, very interested in just, you know, the idea of sort of surfacing and layering, covering up sort of substantial architectural objects with something that's very sort of like temporary and sort of and thin and synthetic. And a piece that came out of that was a curatable, Michael Stanley, who now works at Oxford, the museum in Oxford, helped me to persuade some people who owned a stately home up in Manchester that we would laminate all the floors in their stately home for 3 months. And it was kind of the idea, it was a way, I'd just started working with block printing, because it was a way for me to work very architecturally, very cheaply. So I hand printed these sort of floorboards, and we installed them in a stately home for 3 months. And the visitors of the stately home just kind of came round, shuffled around and kind of looked a bit confused, and then kind of went away, and then it just disappeared. So this is the only record we have of it. A second piece of work is a piece called Super Tudor. And the idea was that this is a piece of work that just exists in a certificate. And it basically, I sold a collector the right to Tudorise their own house in a mock Tudor style. So this is a gallery in New York where the first manifestation of Super Tudor took place. And then we bought this house in upstate New York, and the collector Tudorised his house. And this piece, again, only lives on in its certificate form. Well, this piece actually physically still exists, but the artwork is only the manifestation of the Tudorising taking place. Shortly we're going to demolish this house, and the Tudorising is going to take place on another property that he owns. This is the back of the property. Again, this is called Nice Life, and this is just a wallpapering project in a derelict warehouse in Miami, where we just wallpapered this sort of supersized block printed toile de jouer wallpaper in this area, which was basically it was kind of vagrants lived there, and there was lots of drinking going on and fighting and stuff all over the grass, and it was the police were always being called in. Lots of sort of unpleasant outside activities going on that the police didn't like, and I kind of thought it would be apt to wallpaper it in a sort of toile, just because it was the sort of upper class version of people hanging out in the countryside drinking and doing the things that the police didn't want anybody to be doing in this area of Miami. So this piece again existed for 3 months, and there's the police there, we were watched continually. So these pieces are all block printed, and this piece is called New Build, and this piece again lasted for 6 months, and it was the idea of bringing red brick architecture into the middle of Oxford. This piece is at New College. Let me clad this piece. And this piece, the final piece, was done at the Liverpool Biennale, which where we got a derelict decorating shop, and we just made these sort of logos, which kind of again described sort of self-betterment and the sort of mixture between self-improvement and home improvement. We played around with the logos that we found in the decorating products. And with this piece, we actually made the whole piece. We made the print blocks and the prints in the space. So the kind of piece was just a manifestation of the space itself. And again, this piece lasted, well, this probably lasted a little bit longer because it was part of Liverpool Biennale, but it's obviously none of the work had any meaning outside of the space that it exhibited in, so this piece doesn't exist neither. And that's it.
Thank you, Richard. Natalia?
Hi. This is bound to go wrong, but never mind. So my name is Natalia, and I'm a textile conservator and an artist. And so the question we're going to try and discuss today is, why save anything? And I interpret that really to mean, why bother to collect and preserve and interpret material culture? And by material culture, I mean all the things that we as human beings make. And on the most fundamental reason, I guess the answer is because in conjunction with the written word, the stuff that we make is the best and most durable and sometimes the only evidence of our having been here at all. But I do have to make an admission at this point that I would say that because I'm a bit of a hoarder. This is evidence of that. This is just 4 photos I took a few days ago in my flat. This is not my studio or a spare room. This is kind of the main living space. So I could take many of these photos. I think it's important that I tell you this because if we're going to talk about preserving objects for posterity, it may be important that you're hearing it from a person who has a slight psychological tendency to keep everything. But having said that, the moment you say, why save anything, I think the next immediate question in our situation, in our culture today, is we can't keep everything. You know, we don't have the space. Apart from all the other reasons, which are too many to mention in 5 minutes, we haven't got the space. So decisions have to be made about what we keep, who makes those decisions, and when we do keep things, what are we going to do with them? So this is too much for 5 minutes, and I thought the only way I could tackle this is to try and show you something that I would think would be worth keeping and trying to tell you why I think it's worth keeping. And so these are 2 Afghan carpets. They are carpets because I am a textile conservator, so I'm particularly interested in preserving textile heritage, naturally. I could have chosen many other objects, but, you know, these are perfect. And Afghan carpet art, such as these ones, are a very traditional art form. and they are produced domestically in villages throughout Afghanistan, and they require a lot of patience and skill and talent and time. And there are certain rules about how they're made, certain formal rules about how they appear and what symbols are used. But it isn't a very rigid art form, which allows quite a lot of variation in the design. So why would you keep this? Why would I want to keep this? First of all, for the same reason that I would like to keep a lot of textile material, and that is the amount of raw information that it contains. For example, the weaving and the dyeing techniques can tell us a lot about the tools and technologies available to people who had made these things. And the type of thread and the fiber and the choice of the colors used can tell us about the patterns of trade and or lack of trade that the makers were able to undertake. And their size and shape, as well as very crucially to conservators, the damage, any damage and any staining, can tell us about the intended use, and therefore give an insight into an everyday lives of people who made and lived them, who are not necessarily the major players in history. They are the people whose major ideas don't survive past their lifetime. These are ordinary objects made by ordinary people, and they're extraordinarily beautiful. But there's something else, there's another reason I'd like to keep this. This is a detail of these carpets. And close up, you'll notice that these traditional rugs include stylized images of tanks and grenades and guns and airplanes. I'm sure many of you would have come across these before, and these are in fact Afghan war carpets, which are quite recent. They date from either the recent Soviet or the Western invasion of Afghanistan. And I think they're incredibly important because ordinary people, through adapting very old traditional technique, are trying to make sense of or gain some control, or maybe even to somehow domesticate a cataclysm of war that is raging all around them. What is fascinating also that we, although we know a lot about these carpets, there is a lot we don't know because the people who made them are on the whole unknown. We don't know who they are. And so the motives for which they made them are still unclear. We don't know if they're supposed to be trophies, if they're supposed to be efforts to somehow normalize the situation for themselves domestically, whether people live with these objects, whether they only ever make them for sale, do they give them away? And so when these objects are displayed in the West, and they're displayed a lot, they're very hot at the moment, the normal context is missing about why people made them and what they meant by it. So the objects have to speak for themselves. That's all we have. Maybe one day this will change when the situation in Afghanistan changes. But for now, that's what we have. That's the message from people who we don't know that much about and whose lives we're very closely affecting. So I'll go back to that slide, actually. As a conservator, you can spend a lot of time on one object, and often it's a very ordinary thing. It's not always a valuable work of art. And so you get very involved with this piece. You care for it. You kind of take it apart sometimes, not always. You have to be very careful how you take it apart. And you become responsible for its survival, and you start feeling a kind of sense of ownership. But you have to be very careful as a conservator. You have to be very objective, because what you do affects the future interpretation and survival of the object. But it occurred to me that most objects that I work on spend most of their lives away from human beings. After their useful life is finished, they can spend years away from human beings, hidden somewhere, forgotten about, sometimes buried in the ground for thousands of years. And interestingly, it's then that they undertake their greatest change physically. They can change shape, they can change color, completely change chemical composition, lose their original meaning, lose their original context, and even sometimes lose location if they're buried. And then they are discovered again and come up into a completely new and different circumstance. And the moment they are looked on by human beings, they are invested with meaning, they are invested with value, social value, and monetary value. And so it occurred to me, when these objects are away from us, are they being passively transformed by their circumstances? Or are they in some way transforming themselves in a kind of metaphorical sense? Are these objects, do they have a life of their own? I can't think like that as a conservator. It would be a very bad idea for me to start imagining that objects I work on have an agenda of their own. But as an artist, I have no such restrictions. And these are just four pieces of my work. And so my central idea is, as an artist, is that is there a possibility that artifacts have their own agenda? And they alter themselves and their meaning in order to give themselves a new relevance in a new situation. Past their useful stage of their life, do they actually just try, like all living things, to either adapt or die? Of course, I don't really believe this, but it's a kind of conceit. But I hope this is an idea to explore the meaning, how meaning is created and how meaning is carried by objects. And so it's a way of explore ways in which we put information into objects and the way we take them back out again and how that changes over time. So that's it, but just I have to say at the end that on a deeply personal, kind of subconscious, primal level, some tiny part of me does allow the possibility that inanimate objects have some agenda of their own. And as an artist, at least, you know, that I'm the person to help them do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Natalia. Sorry?
Hi.
And we're running slightly behind time, so we could keep to a tight 5 minutes. Is that okay for you as well, Barry?
Yes, now I have to go even faster. Well, that's good. Some people in the front row are falling asleep, so I want to go fast anyway so I can keep you guys awake. So, hi, I'm Zoe, and the main reason why I'm here before you, it's not really because Sean or Mark invited me. I'm basically that know-it-all girl in your class. I know why we should say things, so that's what I'm here to tell you. I'm here to let you in on the secret. For me, why we should save anything is kind of very much intrinsically tied to another question that's really important to me, and that's what museums are for. And I'd like to say that I was clever enough to come up with the answer by myself, or that it's because I'm always reading art theory, or a certain philosopher or art historian kind of let me in on it, but it was actually a 17-year-old. This thing is not, there we go. It's all about shortening distances. That's why we should save things. And that's what museums are for. That's what this is all about. Shortening distances between the past and the present, between important historical events, between the old and the new, between young people and old people, between different cultures. So all I wanted to do was to say that it's really important that we have conservation and documentation because it actively encourages cultural progress. Historical museum collections in particular, like the one that we're a part of here or the one I work in at the V&A, they can be catalysts for challenging the past, that's one thing, shaping the present, and I suppose that's where I come in as a curator who often works with living artists and designers who are actively trying to shape or sometimes, yeah, challenge or provoke. And I think that's really important. So I just wanted to briefly illustrate my point with some specific examples from projects that I've carried out at the V&A. I won't read you the captions because I will go as quickly as possible. The Norfolk House Music Room at the V&A was a reconstituted interior of a house on St. James's Square, a formal royal residence that was built by the Duke of Norfolk in the early 18th century. And yet, when I invited Yinka Shanibari to come and create a piece, what he decided to do was just use it as an opulent surrounding, a kind of a symbol for the opulent life of a prominent Liverpool slave merchant and his grandson. So here he is in period dress. And this person, the grandson of this wealthy slave merchant, what he was best known for was popularizing archery. And so it becomes a commentary on, you know, whose stories do we tell? What things do we save and what stories do we not? And that's something that Natalia was talking about as well. Here's another one. I worked with a Ghanaian artist named Ellen Atsui, and we were able to show his sculpture, these charred driftwood pieces, juxtaposed with some very monumental mosaics. And it's a cycle of portraits depicting famous artists created between 1864 and 1875. And what we have here is It's referring to the concept of how we assemble things, from different periods of time, shorten those distances between things as a means of telling stories. Elle's figures are all meant to, they're nameless. They're all pieces of driftwood. They're survivors of horrible, horrible things that have happened as a result of the slave trade, as the result of wars in different countries. And yet, there are a number of figures who get elevated, and we remember certain names and we forget others. And here are some of my colleagues installing a very large serpent swallowing his own tail in our garden. And that's the finished piece, just as the pond is filling up. And this is another piece about memory. That serpent, that shape of the serpent swallowing its tail, is all about how we remember. It's a symbol of eternity, but in this case, it's all about the exploitative system of how oil is gotten and circulated around the world. And you'll have to take my word for that, but I can explain it to you in more detail. I don't want to take up everybody else's time. But basically, that was my one point. I think it's important for us to save things because we need to keep those distances as short as possible. Thanks.
I'm speaking to you as a teacher. I've been teaching art to people in your age group for quite a long time. And my question is, why should we conserve works of art? And the answer is very simple, so that as many of us as possible can experience works of art at first hand. Now, what I'm going to try and do with relatively famous works, actually, is explain why you need to experience them at first hand, why seeing them in books or even on the internet, however valuable that may be, is not quite enough. So only by seeing works at first hand and by closely examining the work can we get a sense of how it was made. Now, I'm going to make this point in relation to an object which is in Tate Modern. This is Jackson Pollock's Summertime, which I think is an exceptionally beautiful painting, though not everybody agrees. Jackson Pollock was, in 1948, called Jack the Dripper by one American magazine, and other people have suggested that Jackson Pollock is, in fact, rhyming slang. But Jackson Pollock is an artist, I think, to be taken very seriously. Many people assume that when Jackson Pollock made his work, he made it in a random kind of way, that he basically threw paint at the canvas. But that's so far from the truth, really so far from the truth. When you get up close to the work, in front of it, you see actually how it was made. And you see that, for example, which order he laid down specific paints. And you could see that on a enlarged picture like this, but it's much more immediate when you actually see it in the flesh. When you see it in the flesh, you realise that Jackson Pollock was not somebody who threw the paint like that. He worked more like this, close to the canvas and controlled very exactly what he was doing. You get that impression from studying the works at first hand. Sometimes seeing a work at first hand is the only way fully to understand what it means. And I'm going to use this example, which some of you may know. Does anybody know this work? Nobody? This is Chris Ofili's No Woman, No Cry from 1998. The title is taken from a very famous song by the great and late Bob Marley. But it doesn't refer to Bob Marley. What it actually refers to is this woman here. This is the woman referred to in the title. This is Doreen Lawrence, whose son was killed in 1993 by a... there's Doreen Lawrence. That's Doreen Lawrence, Neville Lawrence, and Stephen Lawrence, who was killed by a group of racist thugs. That's the grandmother at a very tearful press conference. And these are the people who killed him, although they've never been brought to trial. There was a kind of bungled police investigation. The police were accused of institutional racism. There they are again. Nice guys. Two of them are about to be, I think, charged. But in fact, I mean, to really understand how this work works, you have to see it at first hand. You notice when you see it at first hand, for example, that every one of those tears contains a collaged image of Stephen Lawrence. Tiny, tiny things. But the impression of seeing them at first hand is incredibly moving. When you see it at first hand, you also see, and you see it better in the dark, but you can see it underneath in fluorescent writing are the words, "Rest in peace, Stephen Lawrence." Now, I don't want the Stephen Lawrence case ever to be forgotten, and Chris O'Feely's painting helps us to do this, but you only really fully understand the painting, I think, when you see it actually at first hand. And then finally, I think, oh, the other thing is that you don't get to see how big it is until you see it at first hand. It is actually a very big work indeed. And my final point is that sometimes artworks provide you with an experience that you simply could not get anywhere else. And as an example, I've chosen an artwork for the, from a distance. It's Anthony Gormley's Field for the British Isles, which I saw in 1993. From a distance, it looks like a shag pile carpet, a rather brown, unappetizing colour. Close to, you actually realise that there are between 30 and 40,000 tiny clay people looking at you. One of my students actually suggested that one of them looked like Big Bird in Sesame Street, and I thought, you're an idiot. And then I looked very closely and said, yes, there is actually Big Bird in Sesame Street, just there. It doesn't look quite like it. But the point about this is when you see this, you either go away with a smile on your face, and I did, or having 30,000 people looking at you precipitates some kind of personal crisis that requires psychotherapy. It could go either way. It could go either way. But ultimately, you need to see it at first hand. Now, in my concluding point, oh, there's two people seeing it at first hand. I don't know if you recognise them. My final point was actually, I was going to talk about this work. And then I realised that if I talk about this work, I'll actually ruin it for you. So I'm not going to talk about it. This is Mike Nelson's The Coral Reef, which is on display here. They will only let 10 people in at a time to see it, but it is a hell of an experience. And it's exactly what museums like Tate Britain are great at doing. So if you get the chance today, go and have a look at what is behind that rather cruddy-looking door. You will be surprised and more than a little bit creeped out, I think. Thank you.